As you can imagine, a lot of parents are worried with their children who are going to school in the fall. They can't get vaccinated, or they have some underlying immune problems. And even if I had a vaccine, it may not work. So allowing them to go on a study that gives them a boatload of antibodies up front, we hope will protect them as well.
That's Dr. Sharon Nachman, and this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacob Ellis, talking with innovators and experts about health and healthcare in America. Dr. Sharon Nachman has been at the forefront of coronavirus care since the beginning of the pandemic. As chief of the Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at Stony Brook Children's Hospital, Dr. Nachman provides direct care to children, but she's also associate dean for research at Stony Brook's Renaissance School of Medicine, and in that capacity, she's been an investigator on 8 clinical research studies related to COVID-19. Last September, she was appointed to New York's Independent Clinical Advisory Task Force, charged by the governor with reviewing COVID-19 vaccines authorized by the federal government. Dr. Nachman, I want to welcome you to the podcast.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I wanted to talk today about sort of where we are with this pandemic, what's going on with the vaccines, and with schools opening in just about a week, we'll touch on the risks that children are facing in the fall. But let's start with the big news that came out last week. The FDA granted full approval to the Pfizer vaccine. What was your reaction to that?
I want to say I was excited and relieved at the same time. It's been a long time coming. One of the things I always get asked is, why did it take so long from the EUA approval to the FDA approval? What happened? Was there a problem? And the answer is, you have to understand how the FDA works. The FDA never rushes into anything. And the reason we had the early use access or EUA approval was because we needed to save lives. At the time of the EUA approval, over 600,000 Americans had already died from COVID. There was a vaccine. In the clinical trials, it showed that it prevented deaths and hospitalizations. And the FDA took that courageous step of saying, let's get this out. We need to save American lives. That was the step that got us the vaccine so early in 2020. We were able to get people vaccinated. The reason it took till now, until 2021, to get the FDA full approval was that they have a whole bunch of things they have to follow. That includes looking at every single piece of data from every single patient. And as you can imagine, with over 30,000 patients on the study, that was a lot of data. In addition, believe it or not, they have to visit every single plant that makes any part of the vaccine. That means they have to jump on planes and trains, go around the world, and inspect every plant, from the plants that make the glass vials, to the stoppers, to the medication or stuff that's in the vaccine, to even the places that print the labels for the vaccines. So they have to look at everything, and that takes time and manpower. And the FDA is always cautious, and they're always looking to make sure they're not skipping a step or jumping over something. And that takes months. So that's the time it took from the EUA approval to where we are now with the vaccine approval.
That's a very insightful answer. And really, I think most people don't realize how much is involved in granting that full approval. And honestly, this was an expedited process. This wasn't, it felt like a long time, but it really was a very short time compared to the normal FDA approval cycle.
Well, the reason it often takes a long time for an FDA approve a vaccine is, let's talk about how come. Why did that happen? In the usual time, if you're going to have a vaccine study and you want to enroll 30,000 patients, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes months and months and months to find the patients, talk to them about the study, get them to sign, and then get on the study. And then once they're all on study, you have to wait for the placebo group to get sick. So if you have another study, like a pneumonia study, you have to wait maybe 1 or even 2 winters for enough people to get enough pneumonias to say, well, that vaccine prevented pneumonia. In COVID time, the protocol enrolled in 4 weeks. 30,000 patients around the country said, pick me, I'm on the study. And then, unfortunately, we had a lot of COVID. So in that short period of time, so many of those patients that got placebo got sick and got hospitalized. Whereas the people that were on the vaccine, while they may have gotten COVID, they weren't hospitalized and they were very little bit, just a little bit sick. So it's that data that show that the vaccine worked in such a short time because, unfortunately, we had too much COVID floating around.
Yeah. Now, do you anticipate that the Moderna vaccine and even the J&J will be getting full approval in a short time as well?
I am hopefully optimistic that the exact same things will happen with Moderna and J&J. They had the same trial by fire. People enrolled quickly. And as you can imagine, we had an awful lot of COVID floating around.
So we've heard a lot about herd immunity, and I wondered if you might address that a little bit. Explain what that means and what level of vaccination would we need to see in the community to achieve that?
So first of all, herd immunity is a difficult number to get at. And people are throwing out numbers of 70%, 80%, 90%. But it depends on how many variables you put into the equation. It's a complicated math problem. And as you know, with math, the more stuff you throw into it, the more the numbers at the end change. With herd immunity, we have to account for if you got the illness once, are you going to get it again? If we had the vaccine, one or two doses, are you ever going to get the illness? And how quickly can the illness spread? So the herd immunity number for the original or alpha strain of COVID was a different number than the herd immunity number with Delta, which passes so much easier. In the original strain, if we kept our masks on and got pretty much the number of people we have now vaccinated, that would have driven COVID away. But we didn't have that. And we had the Delta strain, which even if you're standing far away, or you've had a vaccine, or you're not wearing your mask, you're still going to get the infection. So that herd immunity question or answer, so to speak, relies on so many different variables and didn't take into account how fast Delta could spread in our communities. And that's why the number that we need to get to herd immunity or protect it is higher now than it was originally. The vaccine does work. It prevents those hospitalizations and those deaths. Will it prevent anyone from ever getting sick? No. This is a respiratory infection in your nose. And vaccines really prevent the late problems, the pneumonias, the blood problems, the kidney problems, etc. So the vaccine's doing that. Is it going to prevent you and I from getting a runny nose, cough, or cold? Not so much. Yes, it will somewhat, but it's not perfect. And if you and I get it, we will continue to spread it.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit, give us a little primer about how vaccines and viruses work together. What is that interrelationship? How do they work? How do the vaccines keep us from developing those late problems?
Certainly. Well, let's think about the virus first. As you know, it's a pretty smart virus. In order to attach to a cell and kind of gain entry into the cell and turn the cell machinery on to make more viruses, it needs to have three fingers of the virus open and able to kind of attach to the cell and throw itself in. The original alpha strain only had one finger open. That meant it needed to use its own energy to open the other two fingers and slip into your cells. It was a little bit harder for it, and therefore it wasn't so contagious because not all those virus particles made the energy to open up and actually get into your cells. The Delta strain has all three fingers open. So once it gets near a cell, it attaches and boom, it sticks itself right into the cell right away. Once it gets into the cell, it takes the cell's machinery and turns it on and says, could you please make more viruses? Your cell makes lots more viruses. They burst out of the cell, killing it, and then they go on to infect new cells. That's how viruses operate. Now let's talk about the vaccine. The vaccine, or the messenger RNA vaccine, has just a small part of that virus. It's not live, it can't grow, it can't do anything. And that messenger RNA goes into your cell, and your cell reads the message. If you remember what you did in elementary school, when a friend slipped a message to you, you read it and ripped it up. That's exactly what your cell does with messenger RNA. It reads the message and says, oh, I need to make this protein. Quick, let's make a protein. And then it rips the message up. It doesn't get read over and over again. It doesn't enter the DNA or the nucleus of your cell because it's not the right language. It can't be read. It has nothing related to it. So once your cell makes that protein called spike protein, it throws it out of the cell. It goes, I kind of don't need this. Throws it out of the cell, then into your bloodstream. Your immune system then says, excuse me, what's this junk floating around? I don't need it. Let's make antibodies, get rid of it, and flush it out of our bloodstream. Once your immune system learns and remembers how to make antibody, it remembers it for a long time. So now when you get COVID infection and your virus has that spike protein or those three fingers we talked about, your cells see that, your immune system sees it and goes, wait, it's that junk that we didn't like last time. Let's make an antibody and kind of pull it out of our bloodstream and get rid of it before it gets into a cell. So that's how the vaccine works to make antibody. And that's how the virus works. And it's your immune system that we need functioning to make that antibody so that when you do see COVID, you kind of pluck it out of your blood system before it gets into your cells. The problem, as you can imagine, is we have some patients that don't have good immune systems. So we know even if we gave them a vaccine, they may not make a good immune response. And then, of course, we have all those children that we've never even tried the vaccine on yet. So we don't know how they will do. So between those adults that don't have good immune systems and children, we need to think about everyone else in our community. How are we going to kind of work around and protect those people? And that's how we vaccinate.
So one of the things that I heard you say was that your immune system remembers that for a pretty long time. But you didn't say forever. So therein, I think, lies this new discussion that we're having about boosters. What is the story there? Does it seem right now they're recommended for immunocompromised adults? And there's some discussion about possibly everybody maybe needing one within a few months. What is that about?
The reason we're having those discussions, no one can stand there and say, I know your immune system will remember how to make this antibody for 6 months or 8 months or 12 months. If we didn't have the Delta strain around and have it being so contagious, we probably wouldn't get pushy and say, okay, everyone should get a booster. But because we know there's so much COVID around, we're trying to maximize any possibility that your immune system is not making enough antibody and boost it up, so that you actually will make enough so that when you do see your COVID virus floating by you, you'll make the antibody and get rid of it. And that's what the boosters are all about. For those patients whose immune systems are not working so well, perhaps the booster will kind of pull them up into the sunlight and say, great, make antibody. But for the rest of us, that extra insurance of tickling your immune system all over again and saying, could you make a few more antibodies, please, may also help us stay on the well side of not getting COVID. So it's a little bit of who you are, where you are, and a little bit of let's take the insurance out to make sure you stay well.
COVID-19 is doing what viruses were designed to do, if someone were to design them, which is to mutate and to find a way to keep propagating themselves, right? And even in the face of vaccines and treatments. So now I'm hearing about the Delta Plus variant. What is that and why isn't it just the next iteration, the Gamma, the Lambda?
So the Delta Plus variant has a few genetic sequences that are just a bit different than the original Delta. And some people have suggested maybe it is a little more contagious, but it doesn't have enough of a difference from the Delta strain that we have circulating right now to get its own name. If, on the other hand, it undergoes much more mutations, then you're right. We'll give it a new name, not Alpha, not Beta, Gamma, Delta. It's going to have its own name. But right now, those few genetic mutations that the Delta Plus has as compared to the original Delta are not big enough for us to say, oh gosh, it's its own strain.
Okay. Do we need to worry about it more, or we just need to maintain our same level of concern that we are all kind of walking around with?
I think the same level of heightened concern is appropriate.
Okay. I wanted to ask you also about the J&J vaccine. So you spoke about the mRNA vaccines. The J&J is a little bit different. If someone has had that one, is it okay for them to get an mRNA as a booster or not?
So I can't answer that question because I actually don't have data on if you got J&J in the past, what should you get as your booster? As you know, J&J just came out with some data that said if you had one dose of J&J and we gave you a second dose now, your immune system would ratchet up, remember, and make lots more antibodies. So I suspect the people that got J&J in the past, when it's time for their booster, may be quite happy to get another dose of J&J. I am sure there are lots of studies going on out there with mix and match. If I got this one, should I get a boost with that or vice versa? But unfortunately, I don't have that data now to say this is the best of the choices. If you're going into a pharmacy now and you have immune compromise and you want to get a booster, most of the pharmacies will say, what'd you get last time? That's what I'm going to give you now. That may change in the next few months if we see some of the alternative suggestions. I got vaccine A, I'm going to get a boost with vaccine B, being a better outcome. So the answer is I don't know what will show, but right now, if you're going to get a booster, it's probably okay to just go ahead and get a booster with the same vaccine you got.
Fair enough. Okay. We are going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with more on the COVID-19 pandemic with Dr. Sharon Nachman. Stay tuned.
Healthcare Confidential is brought to you by Prescriptive Communications, LLC. Analyze, strategize, connect. That's our prescription for healthcare marketing. Prescriptive Communications puts healthcare businesses in front of the audiences they need to reach. If you're ready for a diagnostic on your marketing efforts, get in touch with Prescriptive today. Call us at 631-606-0525 or visit prxcommunications.com. That's 631-606-0525 or prxcommunications.com.
Welcome back to Healthcare Confidential. We're here with pediatric infectious disease expert, Dr. Sharon Nachman, and we're talking about COVID-19 and vaccines. And I wanted to ask you about some of the myths about vaccines that I've heard. I'm sure we've all anecdotally heard some of these. And if you're on social media, you've certainly heard some of the wilder stories. One thing that I have heard is that there's some concern that vaccines might impact on fertility. Can you comment on that?
Certainly. Well, let's start with the easy stuff. Does COVID impact fertility? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. There's a couple of interesting studies looking at young adult males and looking at them 3 months after they've had COVID and showing that their sperm counts are quite decreased. So yes, we know that COVID itself will clearly impact fertility. But what about the vaccine? As we've discussed, the vaccine has to go into your cell in order for your cell to make the protein. It only can get into a few cells. It cannot cross the placenta. It cannot go to the baby because the baby makes the placenta, not the mommy. That's how women can stay pregnant and not lose their babies. Because if we had anything that crossed easily, then it would always attack the baby. So that's how fetuses stay healthy. And vaccines will not cross the placenta and touch the baby. In addition, the receptors for this vaccine are not on the ovary. So your ovary cells will never get any vaccine into them and change any of their machinery. So thinking that it's going to affect your fertility on the pre-implantation or the egg and ovary site versus post-implantation on the placenta site, that's just not happening. In addition, it doesn't enter sperm cells. So thinking a vaccine is going to affect male fertility, it also won't. We also know that all of the companies must study two different animal models to look if vaccine is going to affect anything from fertility to delivery. And those animal studies have not shown it. Well, people say to me, you have to study humans though. And the answer, that's been done too. Pfizer did a nice study enrolling pregnant women and giving them COVID vaccine and showing that their medical issues compared to those that got placebo were no different. Their baby outcomes compared to those that got no vaccine were also not different. In addition, the CDC has now followed about 100,000 pregnant women who had vaccine and showed the exact same thing. So between animal studies and human studies and the cells that would be making the spike protein from the vaccine, the short answer is no. The vaccines will not affect fertility.
That's good news. What about for breastfeeding moms? Is it safe for them to be vaccinated? And does that confer any immunity onto their babies?
So absolutely, it is perfectly safe for women who are breastfeeding and have been vaccinated either during pregnancy or afterwards to continue to breastfeeding. It's a great question about, will that help protect the baby? And the answer is yes. You will make some protective antibody and it will cross into breast milk because the vaccine won't, that messenger RNA won't, and it will help protect your baby. Is it enough? Probably not enough protection. It helps, but it's just not enough. And that's why all of the vaccine manufacturers are looking at getting vaccines into kids as young as 6 months, because by 6 months, any protection from mommy is kind of gone. And that's when we have to start vaccinating.
Well, schools are opening up around the country soon. And in New York State, our new governor, Kathy Hochul, in her first hours on the job, mandated both masks and vaccines for school personnel in New York State. Do you think that was a good move?
I think it is really important and very helpful for all of us in New York to say we are now protecting our children. We must have those kids back in school. We know the Delta virus is clearly passing from child to child and adult to adult. And by masking, we're protecting not only each of those children individually, but all of them collectively and the adults that are in school. So I think it was a bold and very helpful move. And I think it's going to make a difference to us in the coming months. We don't want to see children in the hospital. When I look at Florida and Texas, and I hear that there are no more pediatric ICU beds because of so many cases of COVID in children, I want to say, please, let's not have that happen here.
Are children more susceptible to the Delta variant than they were to the Alpha strain?
It's not a question of more susceptible. It's just that it's a lot easier for them to catch it. And when something is a lot easier to catch and everybody plays together, someone is going to catch it.
Makes sense. And you've been principal investigator for the Pfizer and Moderna pediatric COVID vaccines. What is happening with that? Or do you expect to see a vaccine for children under 12 sometime soon?
So first I wanted to say thank you to all the parents that are participating in these studies. As you can imagine, when we let out the information that we were going to be doing these studies, over 500 different families immediately contacted us and said, please, can we enroll our children on these studies? And those numbers are still increasing. We are getting queries every single day, are there spots left? And those are for kids as young as 6 months to as old as 12 years. So yes, parents are very, very interested in these studies. We are doing vaccines every day here at Stony Brook. We're getting vaccines into these kids' arms. And it will be up to the companies to say, what does the safety data look like 2 months after dose two? So if they got dose one in July and got dose two in August, they need 2 months of safety data. And then looking at all the data, putting it together in a box and sending it to the FDA before it will be reviewed. Will it happen in September? I suspect not. Can it happen anytime in the fall and early winter? I certainly hope so.
And are you still enrolling in those studies, or are you?
This Friday will be our last day for the Moderna for the 5 to 12s. And in September, we'll start with the under 5s. And next week will be our last day for Pfizer 5 to 12s. All the younger children have already been completed.
Okay, excellent. So moving beyond vaccines, are there any treatments in the pipeline that are showing promise against COVID?
As you can imagine, we are using remdesivir, which is approved for adults in children. We anticipate that the dose that we're using in children is the appropriate dose. But it's not all about giving remdesivir. There are other medications that adults are using, like monoclonal antibodies, that we want to use in children too. Regeneron has allowed us to give compassionate use medication or antibody to children. But more importantly, they're saying, what about the kids who can't get vaccinated, that are too sick, or the vaccines are not available, and they're going to school in September? So we will be starting a specific study giving Regeneron as preventative medicine before the kids see their COVID so that we hope they don't get sick. As you can imagine, a lot of parents are worried with their children who are going to school in the fall, they can't get vaccinated, or they have some underlying immune problems. And even if I had a vaccine, it may not work. So allowing them to go on a study that gives them a boatload of antibodies up front, we hope will protect them as well.
That's great news. So for those of us who are fully vaccinated, what kinds of precautions should we be taking? As we hear more and more about breakthrough infections, is it safe to be indoors without a mask? Is it safe to fly in an airplane? Is it safe to visit with other vaccinated people?
So I think, first of all, we need to think of who are we and what are we doing and where are we going? Are we someone that has no underlying medical issues, or do we have significant medical issues? Because that's going to change a lot of our recommendations. If you're someone who's a healthy adult and no medical issues, and you've been vaccinated and it's 2 weeks later, well, you may get COVID. It's most likely it's going to be an upper respiratory infection, runny nose, maybe some cough and cold, maybe some fever. And more importantly, you'll get better, quicker, faster than anyone who never was vaccinated. Can you get together with a group of friends who have been vaccinated? Certainly, as long as you tell them, are you all well? Has anyone been exposed? Is anyone at risk here? And if those conditions are met, I think you can get together with a small group of people without masks. On the other hand, going to a grocery store or a movie theater or even the opera or anything like that will require you to wear a mask the whole time because there's too many people in the audience for you to know everyone about everybody, and you don't want to take those chances. So I think it really depends on who you are, where you're going, and what you're doing. Certainly getting together outside is always a nice alternative now, although it's a bit, you know, warm during the summertime. It's always nicer to meet outside than inside.
Great advice. And lastly, last year at this time, we were hearing a lot about the potential twindemic of the flu and COVID. And that never materialized because we were all doing such a good job of masking up that flu really didn't present itself as a problem last year. Do you have any concerns about it this year?
I am definitely concerned about it this year because I think a lot of people have said, well, I'm vaccinated for COVID. I kind of don't need my mask anymore. I can get together not with 2 friends or 10 friends, but 25 friends. As you know, flu is highly contagious. So it is really possible that we will see people who are COVID vaccinated getting the flu, and then also getting COVID from someone else because they were also not wearing a mask. So I do think we do need to be cautious. I think COVID vaccines are great. I think we will need to encourage people to get their flu vaccine this year as well. And then the same rules apply. If you're ill, please don't go out in company. If you're at your desk at work, please wear your mask if you're going to be having face-to-face contact with someone else. And think about who's at home. Do you have an elderly parent? Elderly aunt and uncle that you're going to be seeing. If you are, can you do it outdoors or can you continue to wear a mask? So it's not just about me, it's about all of us. And that's what we talk about with community protection.
And Dr. Nachman, I just realized I have one last question that somebody asked me to ask you, which is, and this is somebody with young children, as we look forward to vaccines being available for our children, is anybody working on what the logistics of that looks like? Because the big pods that we had for adults, those are, don't really seem to be the right mechanism for vaccinating children on a large scale.
That's absolutely correct. It's going to be awful hard for parents to bring their kids from school, get to a pod during the daytime because everyone's working. As more and more pediatricians or pediatric groups or family medicine groups have the ability to vaccinate, they have the appropriate storage, they know they're going to see enough kids at any given time, I think it's going to be a lot easier to go to your pediatrician or family medicine doc and get your vaccine through them. Of course, it's going to be about scheduling. So they don't want to give one dose, crack a vial, and throw the other doses out. They're going to want to schedule it so that 6 people or 10 people come in at once, crack a vial, and everyone gets a vaccine. So yes, it's going to be a lot easier than it was originally, but that doesn't mean you're just going to walk in at any time and get your shot.
That makes sense. All right. Is there anything else that you'd like to add? Anything I haven't thought to ask you about this topic that people are asking?
So I think you've had a lot of questions about those plastic barriers. And at the end of the day, I think the most important thing that really worked was really the masks. What I tell families that if your child's in school and their mask is wet around midday before they're eating lunch, tell the kid to take it off, put it in their knapsack, take out a clean mask, and after lunch, put on the clean mask. Because as you can imagine, a wet mask just doesn't work.
And doesn't feel good, I'm sure. Well, thank you again for taking the time to talk with us here on Healthcare Confidential. Where can listeners find you or learn more?
I think they can go to their primary care doctors and ask them any of their questions, because at the end of the day, your child's doctor is the expert in them. Just like you go to the expert auto mechanic when your car makes a funny noise, your child's doctor is the expert too, and ask them the questions about things that you don't understand or want to know more about.
Perfect. Great advice. And I want to remind listeners that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available every Monday morning wherever you access podcasts. The show is brought to you by Prescriptive Studios and is hosted on Omni Studio. Our theme song is an original composition written and performed by the fabulous Patrick Pekarsik. Our production assistant is John Roy. Views expressed on the show are solely those of the host and guest and do not reflect any other entity. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation by dropping a note on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Stay well, everyone.